sit here in my room. The lamplight streaming o'er me projects my lonely gloom. My counterpart in agony mocks each tear that falls, and I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls. He's always by my side at night, no matter where I go. He lurks out in the shadows or in the neon's glow. He follows me across the steps, up and down the halls, and I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls. Watch the candle and the flicker of the flame. My writhing shadow twists and turns as though it is in pain. I'm trying to escape the memory my heart recalls, and I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls. Of a love I lost and all the things I planned are as empty as the bottle that I hold in my hands. My soul is buried in the depths of love and life's pitfalls, and I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls.
You were just listening to the Hummingbirds with their version of I Cast a Lonesome Shadow. The song was originally written by Lynn Rustworm and sold to Western Swing country recording artist Hank Thompson around 1960. The 1970s Hummingbirds version that you just heard was sung by Lynn's son Lance. This was arguably one of Lynn's biggest songs, and it has gone on to be recorded by several artists, including Martin L. Gore from Depeche Mode. Good morning, it's Steve Todd. And in this episode and future broadcasts of Musicians FAQ, you'll be learning a lot from Lance about the late Lynn Rustworm's musical career, which includes not only performing and songwriting, but also promoting and archiving country and Western music and memorabilia that potentially would otherwise have been lost forever. Lance followed in his father's footsteps and will be learning about his many decades of performing, songwriting, and recording as well. Later in this series, you'll be hearing about a Sunday evening tradition that Lynn and Lance started in Elmira called the Elmira Sunday Concert Series, which has unfortunately been sidelined due to the pandemic. Let's check in with Lance and go back in time to when it all started. All right, so thanks a lot for listening in to Musicians FAQ on 102.7 CKMS, and I'm sitting here with Lance Rustworm.
Hello.
All right, well, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, and you've been mentioned many times, and I looked at your liner notes, and it's funny how many names I recognize off your CD. Lots of familiar musicians.
Well, it goes back to being Lynn Rustworm's son, because he knows everybody, or knew everybody. I'm still not used to it. He's been gone since 2016, and I'm still not used to that.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, he knew everybody in the country music industry, and, you know, he started out, and I think he came from Karlsruhe near Hanover originally.
I know where that is.
And he came down here to get a job in 1949, I think.
Wow.
48 or 49.
Okay.
He found a job at the B.F. Goodrich
rubber
plant on his first day in town.
Okay.
and he worked there till he retired in 1984, I think.
Okay.
And but that wasn't his life, you know. That was his day job, and he was really into music and as a songwriter, as a fan, and so, you know, as soon as he came into town, I don't know, I know he boarded at a place around the on Wellington Street, around the corner from the B.F. Goodrich.
So he was just early 20s. Was he with your?
I think he was 19. He
wow.
Said,
okay.
I
so
think.
Before he was with your mom.
He was born
mom,
in 1930. Yeah. So that would make sense.
He'd
be 19. So Anyway, I know he was boarding in a boarding house on Wellington Street with and one of the boarders there. I don't know if he worked at Goodrich too, but it was a guy named Stan Taylor. I've heard his name come up in some of your interviews too. But he was a really good guitar player. But they were just learning at the time. You know, they were only like teenagers.
Yeah, for sure.
And anyway, yeah, Stan ended up playing in my dad's band for years, and he later ended up playing on some TV show. Tommy Hunter or one of those shows, you know, he was on here and there. He was with a band called the Rhythm Masters. They're the band that I think Grant couldn't think of. The Chaparrales.
Okay, yeah.
Earl Freese was with them just before the Chaparrales with Carl Keese and all that.
Okay, great.
They were called the Rhythm Masters. They did an album called Flying High. I remember some of the stuff from my childhood I used to listen to. But I remember my dad pointing out, my friend Stan Taylor's on this album. Wow, this would have been... you know, in the very early 60s or so. Yeah, so my dad came around the end of the 40s. Wow. And he said he used to hang out at a restaurant. I think it was called the Golden Lion or something.
Okay, yeah.
It was where the TV station is now.
Oh, CKCO?
Yeah, on King Street, across from where the hospital is. I guess back then there was a restaurant. I think it was the Golden Lion. I saw another interview recently that Betty Thompson did with another musician.
Okay.
He was talking about it. But not many people remember that anymore. I just know because of my dad talking about it. And I know he started to know musicians there. And I think he wrote a column for some fan magazine.
Really?
So
okay.
He'd be pursuing people for interviews and stuff. So he got to know a lot of people. And I know one of the first jobs, you know, he played with Johnny Siska and the Western Airs.
Yeah, I recognize that name.
Yeah, and they were a very popular band from then on. I knew Johnny in the 70s. He was still playing, too.
So is that part of that, the Silver Bar Ranch? Is that the same name?
It's the same band.
Okay, same band.
Johnny Siska and the Western Airs, I think, became the Silver Bar Ranch Boys for the TV station. And Dad was with them.
Wow.
I think as vocalist, if not vocalist, certainly rhythm guitarist. Dad was a really good swing style rhythm guitar player. He could play that old style, you know.
And later on in this interview, we're going to hear your album or parts of it. And you also have that same Western swing flair for a lot of the songs, too. So like a lot of that same style kind of progresses.
Dad liked Western swing, and I got that off him too. And Western swing again is a pretty obscure thing. Most country fans don't necessarily even like Western swing. Yeah. Gets a little bit too close to jazz sometimes. Yeah. I don't know, but locally the Western Swing Authority has made Western swing really cool because everybody knows all that material, all the old Bob Wills stuff and all that. But anyway, Dad always did like that, and I kind of liked that because of Dad, you know, even though, so I when I was a little kid, I was a little brat who'd be running around at shows because my parents would be on stage playing, and there'd be nobody to watch me, so when I was like 3 years old, I'd be running around between.
So your mom actually played then as well?
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, my parents met in, I was born in 53.
Okay.
And, they met just before that. Yeah, the family lore goes that my mom liked to sing and she wanted to enter a talent contest. She needed somebody to back her up.
Okay.
And I think she phoned the Musicians Union or somebody and they gave him my dad's name.
Really? Okay.
So he went to back her up at the show and mom didn't win the show, but she won Dad. That's what the story goes.
That's a great.
I later heard that it wasn't true, but you know what? I have... In the material that Dad left me, I found proof that it was exactly that way.
Wow. We're going to hear another song off the Hummingbirds album called Drifter. This one is sung by Lance and written by Lynn Rustworm and Larry Mercy. Back in the 60s, Larry Mercy was going to release the song Drifter, but an American TV series starring Marty Robbins went on the air with the same name, so the project was put on hold.
Into town, but he never stays long. Got too many places to see. One hand on the throttle, one on the bottle. A drifter's he. Drifter. A drifter's he. His pockets are empty, but he doesn't care. He's just like the wild wind, so free. Just over the next hill,
looks for the next thrill. A drifter is all he can be. Drifter, drifter, a drifter is all he can be. Pretty girls in his travels each day. His freedom they don't like to see. But wheels are for leaving, girls are for grieving. A drifter like me. Drifter, drifter, a drifter like me. A drifter like me. A drifter like me. A drifter, like me.
Dad kept everything. I've got scrapbooks. He's got the letter that Mom got that she didn't win the contest.
Wow, okay.
In 1951 or 52 or whenever this was.
That's great.
You know. So anyway, that's how my parents met. So yeah, they did work together. At that time, Dad was, you know, I have pictures of them going to, you know, in those days, they used to go to all the country shows that would come around here. And in those days, you could get backstage at all these shows, you know, not like today where the security and everything. But I got pictures of Mom and Dad with Johnny Cash at KW Auditorium, Ernest Tubb, Webb Pierce.
Okay.
You know, I've got some really cool pictures.
So would your dad have been like playing at the same night as well, or just part of the crowd? Or
no, he'd be just part of the crowd.
Okay.
I remember, too, when I was older, too, in the early 60s, I'd go with Dad. They used to have country music compilation shows at the KW Auditorium.
Okay.
And I remember seeing Marty Robbins there going backstage.
Wow.
And I remember Marty Robbins chasing my little sister around. She was only like 1 year old.
Oh, okay.
He was chasing her around.
Yeah, that's neat.
Playing with her and all that. Skeeter Davis, I remember. Oh, Kitty Wells, you know, all the classic people. They all played at Kitchener Odd. They'd have these package shows, you know, with a bunch of artists that would go through there.
I still find that amazing, too. Like, I know just from talking to people about Wingham, how many people actually travel to Wingham, and it's the same thing with Kitchener. Like, how many big Nashville stars would have come through here?
Yeah, well, country music was not what it became later on. You know, it was a niche thing back then. And, you know, the Barn Dance was on CKNX Wingham because it suited the area. You know, it was a country show for country audiences, you know.
Yeah.
Later on, CKNX, you know, when they revived the Barn Dance in recent years, CKNX was not that interested in being involved with it anymore because I think they thought it was too much of a hayseed image or whatever, you know. So, so they, you know, but back in those days, it was a product of the radio station.
Oh yeah, that's before TV really was popular, I guess, right? Like way
yes.
back.
Yeah. I don't know when they started the Barn Dance thing, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, but it was, sometime in the, you know, it was already going strong when Dad started. And I know he wanted to get on the Barn Dance, too. And I've got letters between him and Earl Haywood. And, you know, they rejected them at first, but eventually got on the
wow,
show.
Okay.
Dad played with, going back to the Silver Bar Ranch Boys or Johnny Siska and the Western Airs, which is the same band as we've established. Dad left to form his own band, and that's when Earl Freese joined that band.
Okay.
He became the singer. Anyway, Dad formed a band called the Pine River Troubadours.
Okay.
My mom and dad were billed as the Pine River Sweethearts. So they played around. I don't know. I was just like a baby at the time. Yeah. But, you know, as I got older, I got to know the band members and all that, you know, because I was, you know, the first child. So I was taken along everywhere.
And he was writing all kinds of songs and everything at this point?
Yeah, he'd been writing songs. Yeah, I've even got stuff from when he still lived up on the farm, you know. Rejection. Dad kept every acceptance or rejection letter he ever got over the years. Of course, the vast majority of them are rejections. But again, a cool thing about them, he kept them. A lot of them are signed by the actual artists, you know, like Ernest Tubb, you know, sorry, we can't use your material or, you know, people like that. I'm jumping ahead a bit here, but Dad, you know, it was a big deal to make a trip to Nashville to push his songs. He finally got the money together and the time in 1964. He decided to, so my mom and dad went down to Nashville for 2 weeks. You know, that was, you know, dad was, he was a factory worker supporting a growing family, yeah, so he never had much money, you know, so he didn't travel much or anything, so that was a big deal to him to go down there. Unfortunately, the week he went there, you know, here's the interesting story. Dad was making the rounds of all the publishers with his, you know, he had demos of his songs on tape. He went to Jim Reeves' house because that's where his office was.
Okay, yep.
They went to my dad and mom went to Jim Reeves' house. His wife, who ran his business for him, said, "Sorry, Jim isn't here. He's flying in any second." That's when he crashed.
Oh,
Jim Reeves crashed while he was on his way in that same day. Wow. And unfortunately Dad, as well as Jim Reeves, everything shut down in town for the whole week he was there because of Jim Reeves' funeral. You know, that was, he was like huge. He was like, you know, he was the top artist of his day. And so I think whole town shut down.
I remember you actually singing, and again, we're going to be, I'm jumping way ahead to when we're talking about you in Elmira, but I think you even sang some Jim Reeves, Four Walls or something.
I grew up with that stuff. Yeah. I do several Jim Reeves songs.
Yeah, for sure.
It suits my voice is, too low for a lot of, to do a lot of type of songs, you know? So anyway, so that's when Dad finally made it to Nashville and it was kind of a bust for him. Yeah. I know he met Hank Thompson, whom he worked with exclusively. Well, it's hard not to jump around here. So going back to the 50s, Dad started out, my mom and him, they played a lot on a show called the Main Street Jamboree.
I've never heard of that.
Which was done in Hamilton. It was a barn dance type show. And that's where Gordy Tapp and Tommy Hunter started on that show. Gordy Tapp was the MC on the Main Street Jamboree. So Dad and Mom got a lot of play on that. This would be, I guess, mid-50s. I actually have set lists in Dad's stuff. In his scrapbook. He kept everything. He's actually got set lists of what they played in 1956 at the Main Street Jamboree, what they played at the Barn Dance in 1957. As I said, the Barn Dance didn't hire them originally, but after they were on the Main Street Jamboree, they did end up on the Barn Dance. I know Ernie King did a song of Dad's called Dreamboat Let's Pretend, if I recall. And Earl did some, and you know, Dad did sell a few songs here and there.
You're going to hear a song that Lynn Russworm wrote called A Girl in the Night. Lynn sold the song to the 1950s Western swing country star Hank Thompson. I'll let Lance tell the rest of the story after we listen to Hank Thompson's version of Lynn's song.
She lives her life in honky-tonks and crowded backstreet bars. A world of make-believe that knows no sun or moon or stars, just the glitter of the great wide way and the glare of city lights. Where music's loud, she's in the crowd, a girl in the night. I wonder if she's thinking of dreams that didn't last. I wonder if she's haunted by heartaches from the past. Perhaps there is a story of a love that wasn't right. Now shadows hide her empty pride, a girl in the night. She's sitting there so lonely as she lights a cigarette. The smoke rings rise and in her eyes there seems to be regret. Is she there to tempt a lover in a dress that hugs her tight? A glass of wine to pass the time, a girl in the night. I wonder if she's thinking of dreams if she's haunted by heartaches from the past. Perhaps there is a story of a love that wasn't right. Now shadows hide her empty pride. A girl in the night.
The biggest break for him to date in the 50s was when Hank Thompson did one of Dad's songs. I know Grant couldn't think of his name in the interview. Shame on you, Grant. But Hank Thompson, again, he's not well remembered today, but in the 50s, he was absolutely huge. You know, he started out in the late 40s with his first hits, and his first really big hit was The Wild Side of Life, which, you know, it wasn't God who made honky-tonk angels and all that. That was Hank Thompson. And his band was actually a Western swing band. Again, the Western swing connection comes up. But he prided himself on being the other Western swing guy as opposed to Bob Wills. So I know Dad said there was a rumor that Hank told his band, anybody plays a Bob Wills lick and they're fired. You know, so he had a Western, he had a big Western swing band, and they, you know, they worked out of Oklahoma or Texas. But anyway, you know, the music's associated with both. So Hank Thompson was a pretty big star through the 50s. And anyway, he did like some of my dad's material. He was the first big star to go for it, I think. I'll tell you the story of the one song is he bought a song off my dad. You know, people, you could sell a song or you can, you know, co-write it with them. Yeah. Dad later co-wrote a bunch of songs with Hank Thompson. But I think the first one was a song called A Girl in the Night. Dad sold it outright to Hank Thompson. And I've got the paperwork for it, the receipts. He sold it for $250, which was huge money back in, you know, Dad was probably making like $70 a week in those days, you know, like in the 50s.
For sure.
So with a young family. So he sold the song. Hank always rewrote them extensively. So Hank did the song, put it on an album. It was never a hit or anything, but it got around. And then a few years later, Ray Price recorded that song. So, of course, since Dad sold it outright, it's strictly a Hank Thompson song. Dad's name is not on any of this stuff. Anyway, Ray Price did a really cool version of the song, and it was on an album. This would be maybe 58.
Wow, okay.
I'm not sure. Maybe a little bit later. It sounded a lot different than Hank Thompson's version. Hank Thompson's version was kind of jazzy for the day, like with his band. Yeah. He did some pretty sophisticated arrangements. The thing about Ray Price's version is about sometime like a year later, he did his giant breakthrough hit was called City Lights. The song is almost identical to the way he did A Girl in the Night. Yeah. I think the choruses are different, but the fiddle intro is virtually identical in a different key. It's almost like Ray Price kind of, when he did the song City Lights, he said to his band, remember that version we did of A Girl in the Night 6 months ago? Well, let's do it the same type of song, you know. And then it became Ray Price's huge breakthrough.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, including that distinctive fiddle solo, which we duplicated on my CD. You know, we went for the Ray Price version. So anyway, if you listen to the two songs, like they're, it's amazing.
Sure.
And I've seen people, like on the internet, I've looked them up on YouTube, and people have said, hey, that one song, they stole, A Girl in the Night stole the fiddle version from City Lights.
Okay,
well, it's the other way around,
but
it's not stolen because Ray Price and his band did both.
Yeah,
so, you know. And another footnote to that story is Dad met Ray Price years later at one of his, you know, when he'd get backstage to see somebody. And he said they were just winding down. He told Ray Price, oh, by the way, I actually originally wrote A Girl in the Night, and Ray Price had no idea. He'd bought it off Hank Thompson, you know. He said, Ray Price gave me a really funny look, and we both agreed Ray Price probably thought you were going to try and hit him up for some money or something. Dad was just trying to conversationally mention that, by the way, I sold that song outright to Hank Thompson. That's all that ever came of that.
No, that's great, though.
I know in recent years towards the end of his life, Dad said, I wonder if I could get the rights to put my name back on that song, you know, and I said, but the song is published by forget the name of the publishing company. They're the biggest in the world. They're the ones that do Michael Jackson.
Oh, okay,
You know, and that's who Hank's songs ended up with, you know. And so I don't think that'll ever happen.
No, but
But anyway, that's an interesting story. Yeah, and people might say I'm making this up, but you know, I do have the paperwork of Dad selling the song.
Let's hear what Lance was just discussing, the similarity between the opening fiddle lead for Lynn Russworm's song A Girl in the Night and City Lights, both recorded by Ray Price.
She lives her life in honky-tonks and the crowded backstreet bar. A bright array of city lights as far as I can see.
All right, we're back. Thanks for listening to Musicians FAQ. I'm Steve Todd, and let's continue our interview. So he's working at the tire plant during the day, and he's probably playing at local.
Yeah, playing always, you know, within 100 miles of here. Yeah. You know, they play, back in the 50s, they didn't have bars, didn't have music, so they didn't play in, you know, they played in dance halls.
Yeah.
And there'd be some place that would hire bands. But other times, the bands would make their own opportunities, you know. Dad said they'd often go into a town, they'd rent the dance hall for Saturday night, and then they'd put up their own posters. I remember, again, as a little kid going around with Dad.
Oh, fun.
You know, I remember being in New Hamburg for some reason. That's probably the first time I knew the name New Hamburg when I was a little kid, that we were going around. Dad was stapling posters on telephone poles, you know, for the Saturday night dance their band was having. And that went on. Yeah, all through the 50s. And I'll say my singing debut was in the 50s with Dad's band.
Oh, really? Okay, that's neat.
I think it was 1959, which would make me like 6 years old.
Wow, okay.
And my dad had a regular show on CJOY radio station. They got me to sing Jingle Bells and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer with his band. So that was my singing debut. And I, incidentally, the DJ was Larry McIntyre, who everybody in Kitchener knows as he was a longtime personality on Channel 13, CKCO TV. He's retired now. He's on one of the Facebook groups about history of Kitchener and the broadcasting industry and all that. One of the members of my dad's band was a guy named Alex Malenik. He was a singer, and his son Gary became a well-known rock and roll guitar player in the 80s. He played with a band called Glider.
I know Brett Bossenberry that's in, he's still in that band, I think.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I never knew him, really. Yeah. I never really knew him, but I just know he was Alex's son. I knew his dad, you know, back in the 50s. And anyway, he actually sent my dad some photographs from those days, and one of them was a picture of Dad's band and me on Larry McIntosh's shoulders when I played that, my first singing to debut when I was 6 years old.
Yeah.
So there's a picture of us all, which I'll show you later.
This might be jumping ahead, but you mentioned to me on the phone how you were probably a little bit older, maybe early teens, but you recorded a song and sent it off to Larry Mercy's studio.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's something you
want to talk about. No, actually, Dad was doing some demos for Larry Mercy.
Okay.
This would be very late 60s.
Okay.
69, 70. And Larry Mercy wasn't interested in Dad's songs, but he he asked Dad if I did the singing on it.
Yeah.
And I was really shy when I was a kid. I would not sing in public. I hated music in school because it'd make you go up and sing. I didn't think it was relevant as a kid. I remember thinking, it's weird. How come they make us sing Do, Re, Mi and all this stuff in school? I've never heard my dad say to his band, this song is in the key of Do. So it just didn't seem to be like the same relevant music they taught. And as I said, I didn't like singing in public. They made me sing soprano, and I probably had a nice alto voice when I was a kid, you know. I think that's changed a bit.
Oh, but,
but anyway, kids would snicker and be singing soprano, so I hated singing in public. Anyway, I was just learning to play when I was about 14. I learned how to play. You hear musicians talk about how they had to learn to play on a cigar box guitar or some crappy Stella or something.
Yeah.
you know, Dad had Gibsons laying around the house, and I ignored them. I never considered music as a career. I always had a vague idea that I'd be an artist when I grew up because I was pretty good at drawing and stuff. So anyway, but when I got to be high school age, all of a sudden, you know, music became important. Yep. You know, girls like guys who played guitar.
And, no, I know what you mean.
But the real reason I started playing guitar is because Dad had an auto harp. And he had a version of an auto harp called a guitaro, which is a little bit easier to play, but very similar to an auto harp. You push a button for a chord. Okay. So I didn't have to learn chords. So I started strumming on this thing, and hey, I could make music really easily with it, you know? So, and then I started getting frustrated. It only had so many buttons, and I saw a chord that I couldn't play on this thing. So I started learning guitar. And so I was around 14 then. So I did start playing, but I wouldn't sing in public, you know? So Dad would hear me singing around the house, and he'd say, "You've got a pretty good voice," but, you know, even into high school in grade 9, you know, I remember they had a folk singing club at the school, and I thought that was neat, but I wouldn't join because I didn't want to, you know. So, anyway, I think I was about 17 when my dad talked me into singing some songs for these demo tapes. So anyway, Larry Mercy heard them and asked Dad if he'd send me over to talk to him. So I went over to his house. Larry told me he thinks I have potential to be a country artist, you know. And again, I wouldn't admit to even liking country music, as well as being shy. I wouldn't sing in front of anybody. I really, if anything, I was hoping maybe I could be a rock and roll guitar player or something, you know. Although that never panned out. But anyway, I turned Larry Mercy down, and he was giving me a great opportunity, you know. You know, any artist would love for, you know, because the Mercy Brothers at that time were, you know, Canada's number one singing group. And he, I think he was just looking to get into managing talent. Yep. You know, later on he did Marie Bottrell and Terry Kariss. I know where people, Terry Kariss wrote some really nice songs for them back in the 60s. Anyway, I guess he wanted to do that, and he would have, you know, he would have taught me the ropes and got me going and everything, a golden opportunity anybody would kill for, and I turned him down because I was 17 and
he's
pretty stupid, you know, like all 17-year-olds.
Well, like you said, you probably thought you felt more like you're going to be an artist more than a musician probably at the time, right?
I did. Yeah, I liked music, but I, you know, the funny thing is, growing up, I heard country music all the time around the house. We didn't dare. We wouldn't even think of watching TV the night that Don Messer's Jubilee was on, or Tommy Hunter's show, or, you know, certain shows like that. Later on, it was Ian Tyson had a TV show with the Great Speckled Bird. There were some really good musicians in that band. But I didn't necessarily watch those shows, but I'd hear them. They were on all the time, you know. Like, again, my mom on the radio, she actually liked big band stuff when she was young, you know. It was Dad who got her singing country more. So we'd hear, you know, today what they call middle of the road, you know, we called it pop music back then. Today pop has come to mean mainstream, but back then, you know, I'm talking stuff like Andy Williams, you know, I know my mom really liked Les Paul and Mary Ford. You know, so I'd hear music like that, but it wasn't until I got into high school again that I didn't even, you know, I watched the Beatles in 1964, like every other kid my age, everybody, I guess, watched that famous Beatles show that introduced Beatles show on Ed Sullivan, right? And I watched it, and I found it interesting. I remember commenting to my dad about, you know, the long hair those guys had. And, you know, but it seems that every other guy I knew who became a musician said they ran out and bought a guitar because of that. They wanted to play rock and roll, and I just watched it and thought it was interesting, and that's all, you know, because that was, I think I would have been 11 when that came on. Whereas, again, I told you, I didn't start playing guitar till I was 14, 15, you know. And the guitar playing I learned was Gordon Lightfoot. It was folk, you know, and acoustic guitar, you know. I had Gordon's first 3 or 4 songbooks, and they were actually really good for learning guitar. They actually had guitar arrangements in the songbooks rather than piano arrangements. So you could actually play them just like the record from that. And so that taught me a lot. But I should mention, too, mentioning Larry Mercy, you know, that Larry and Dad go back to the 50s, because Larry was from Hanover, as was my dad. And I'm not sure how and when they met, but I know that some of the first jobs Larry ever played were with the Barn Dance and with my dad's band. I think he filled in as a singer when he was only he was only about 16.
Okay.
And I know on the Barn Dance, he said Larry Mercy was the rockabilly guy. in those days. All the girls would swoon over him and all that, because he'd do all, because they were trying to, mid-50s, of course, is when Elvis hit. And all the country guys were scrambling as, how can we get on this? You know, nobody's listening to country anymore. It's all this new music that this Elvis guy is doing. You know? So Larry Mercy was their answer to that on the button dance.
That's great.
You know? So that's how my dad and Larry, like, they've known each other forever. That, and in fact, the very first song the Mercy Brothers recorded was written by my dad.
Really? Okay.
Just the snap of your fingers, and I'll come running back. Just one glance from those brown eyes, and I'll take another chance. Why go out searching for a new romance, when just the snap of your fingers will bring me running back? Last summer, one night the moon shone bright. You whispered that you loved me as I held you oh so tight. Then when the leaves came falling, you said you'd someone new. Your new love has stopped calling, he's left you sad and blue. So just the snap of your fingers, I'll come running back. Just one glance from those brown eyes, and I'll take another chance. Why go out searching for a new romance, when just the snap of your fingers will bring me running back? Just the snap of your fingers will bring me running back. Bring me running back. Bring me running back.
It's Steve Todd, and you're listening to Musicians FAQ on 102.7 CKMS. Let's return to our interview with Lance Russwurm as he talks about the song Snap of Your Fingers, written by Lynn Russwurm and recorded by the Mercy Brothers.
The Everly Brothers were hot then.
Yeah.
Can you tell? You know? This would be, I think, 1960.
Okay. That's awesome. And so your dad would have sold that song then, or he would have the rights to it?
I'm not sure what the arrangement was there. Like, the arrangement is always different, you know, like there's, the writer has the rights, they remain his unless he signs them away, but usually there's a publishing company involved. Dad certainly retained the rights to this one, so his name's listed on the credit. You know, a lot of artists, like Elvis was famous back in the 50s, Colonel Parker being a hard-nosed so-and-so.
Yeah.
If Elvis recorded your song, Elvis would get half of the royalties. That's actually one of the most profitable things about music is writing the song,
absolutely.
Not performing it. It's having the publishing rights.
Yeah.
And Colonel Parker wouldn't let Elvis record a song unless the artist signed over half the rights to Elvis. So Elvis was always listed as a co-writer.
Yeah.
To his credit, Elvis found out about that and said, I'm not doing that. That's not right.
Yeah.
So, oh, another interesting Dad Elvis story. Elvis's first hit, Heartbreak, well, not his first hit, his first big nationwide hit for RCA after he left Sun was Heartbreak Hotel.
Okay.
It was written by May Axton. She was a mover in the industry then. She wrote songs, did stuff. Her son was Hoyt Axton, who later became a country star in the 70s. He had a few hits, and I think Drugs did him in and all that. May Axton, wrote Heartbreak Hotel. Yeah. I remember Dad telling me that, you know, that Hoydax's mother wrote Heartbreak Hotel. So Dad, I don't remember him telling me, but I went through his papers. I found all kinds of correspondence. Dad knew Mae Axton well.
Oh, you're kidding.
She had a bunch of his songs that she was pushing for years down in Nashville. This would be in the 60s by then.
So your dad was really well connected, though, because if he's able to get in front of...
Well, I don't know. He just kept at it.
Good for him.
Every week he'd go to the post office with you know, a whole bunch of parcels with little 3-inch reels of tape.
Yep.
They'd have like one or two songs on them as demos, and they'd be going out to different companies down in Nashville. And, you know, so occasionally somebody would bite. Usually they wouldn't. You know, so you know.
But he had what's the right word? Tenacity or.
The tenacity, yes, he just kept at it, you know. Yeah. He was not a strong singer, you know, he knew that, but he started bands and he got people, you know. He had that success with Hank Thompson, which I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
You know, he later on, Hank Thompson actually did co-write several songs with Dad, so I have a lot of correspondence between Dad and Hank Thompson. And again, I grew up heavily influenced by Hank Thompson, but I really didn't know that. I just sort of, a few years ago, came to the conclusion, you know, I used to play a style of guitar. Like I said, I learned a lot from early Gordon Lightfoot stuff, you know. I also like to put in a style like this, where you're...
Well, that's nice, yeah.
You know, that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And, but you didn't hear... It, when I was playing in bars, you heard guys playing the Buck Owens style, you know, twangy Telecaster style. And I always liked this sound, you know. And then later on, I realized, oh, I know, I'm getting it from Scotty Moore off Elvis Presley's early stuff. Like, That's All Right, Mama, because he put a bit of Travis picking in there.
Yep.
You know, they call it Travis picking. And I said, and then it finally it hit me, wait a minute. Merle Travis, who Travis picking is named for, played for Merle, for Hank Thompson all those years.
Oh,
Dad
really?
Was dealing with him. So all those old Hank Thompson records I grew up with had Merle Travis playing that type of stuff. So I guess I got to say, he was a big influence on me, although I didn't really realize it. You know, I started learning how to finger pick, but I was thinking it was like Gordon Lightfoot, folky stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Carl Smith did a song of Dad's.
Okay.
Carl had a big hit called Loose Talkin', and it's probably... Before your time.
Yeah, because I don't recall the name, but I'll look it up.
Even if you're into country, people don't know this stuff, but being Lynn Russell said, I couldn't help but absorb it. And anyway, Carl Smith, he actually had a TV show that was pretty popular in the 60s. You know, I think probably his big hits were in the 50s, so I think it was actually a Canadian-made TV show.
Okay.
He had a song called Loose Talkin' anyway, and Dad wrote a sequel to it called No More Loose Talkin', so Carl Smith put that out. He had a couple of bluegrass songs. A band called the Lewis Family did a song called Across the River from Here. They were a Nashville bluegrass band, or I don't know if Nashville, but an American well-known bluegrass band.
Across the river from here, I'll stand beside him someday, I know. Across the river from here, my home will be in that mansion there. Across the river from
here. This or that, he had various country artists, you know,
well,
lesser known artists did it. But the song of his that has had the most legs is that one that Hank Thompson did called I Cast a Lonesome Shadow.
Yeah, okay. I'm familiar with that.
I just got it out this morning. I have one of those Bear Family compilations. That's a company in Germany that makes beautiful CD collections of all of an artist's work. And I have two huge collections of Hank Thompson stuff. They actually have beautiful hard-covered books that come with them. Anyway, in there, it actually mentions the song called I Cast a Lonesome Shadow. Hank Thompson liked it because it had an Edgar Allan Poe feel to the lyrics. It was a very bleak and a very weird song, you know. Have you heard the original Hank Thompson
version? No, I only heard the... I looked up the Depeche Mode version, which is probably so far different than the...
Absolutely.
It's almost a spooky type of that's cool.
Every evening when the sun goes down, I sit here in my room, and the
Merle Travis is on guitar on this.
Okay.
Projects my lonely gloom. My counterpart in agony mocks each tear that falls.
So what's, do you know the history behind your why your dad wrote the song? Or?
No.
It's sort of a...
No, Dad. I know...
That day at work or something?
I know somebody... I think it was Dwayne King that told me that, boy, listen to your dad's songs. You think he's the worst cheater and everything. And my dad absolutely was not like that. He's, the absolute opposite of the image of a musician. You know, he was a straight-laced, narrow guy. Yeah. You know, he worked all those years raising a big family and would never cheat anybody or anything, you know. Anyway, so no, he just come up with poetic image. Like, he followed everything, you know. He liked watching shows. So I don't know where he came up, but it does have some... Again, I don't know how much of this is Dad's, though, because Hank Thompson would agree. And Thompson said, he wrote the melody, but I'm sure the imagery, too, was probably mostly Hank's. But anyway, Dad's name is still on it.
That's great.
You know, besides, he bought that song off Dad outright, but every other song, Dad, even though Dad might only have written the title or something, he'd always get a co-writing credit, you know. None of them were hits, but this one Hank liked. You know, he put it on a lot of albums. I've got a bunch of vinyl. Dad kept all the records, anything that has his song on it. I've got them. And I'll bet you this song showed up on about 3 or 4 albums that Hank Thompson did. You know, some were compilations. One was a live album, live at the State Fair of Texas, early 60s. This song came out in 1961. One thing I remember about it is when it first came out, Hank sent a single to Dad. We were so poor, we didn't even have a record player in the house. Dad had an old 78 player that could play 78 records, but we couldn't play this 45. And I remember we had to go to somebody's place to hear Dad's single on this. Okay. And Dad asked me to try and remember the new tune that was new to him because Hank had rewritten it.
Yeah.
And so he could repeat it back, you know. So I do remember that song in 61, you know, as a kid. So I've always thought it was neat.
Yeah.
But I know Dad and Hank both agreed that it was probably too weird for the country market back then. It was too, but even the Bear Country compilation, it says in the text there, the writer of the book that goes with that compilation says he thinks it's one of Hank's best songs.
Really? Okay.
But it never really was a hit, you know, but Hank pushed it. And but then, you know, out of the blue, about 10 or 12 years ago, I don't know where we heard about it. It may have been from Bob Youngman. Do you know that Depeche Mode has a version of this song out? And I can't remember who discovered this. They must have done a name search on Lynn Russwurm or something, or Lance Russwurm or whatever, and that came up. But anyway, it was Martin L. Gore of Depeche Mode, which is a techno-pop band from Europe.
Sure.
And they're really big in Europe, not so much here, but worldwide, you know. I heard Grant's interview and Dad said that was by far the largest royalty check I ever got.
Yeah, that's,
it was
that's
something
amazing.
Like 16 grand or something.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was. But...
Every evening when the sun goes down, I sit here in my room and the lamplight shining on me projects my lonely gloom. My counterpart in agony mocks each tear that falls, and I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls.
There's a whole generation of people that knows the Depeche Mode song, and they have no idea it wasn't written by Martin L. Gore, because it's done so totally different than that. And then in the mid-70s, Dad did an album, and I did a version of I Cast a Lonesome Shadow on there. After the Depeche Mode version, the song seemed to be around in a lot of modern rockabilly bands like it. It has a feel that kind of, I don't know. So anyway, the last I heard of it was a year or two ago. There was a series, which I haven't seen because it's on one of the pay TV networks, which I don't get, called American Gods, a TV series. And I guess the song for the season opener or closer was that by a guy named Charlie Crockett in the States. He's some modern alternative, Americana type artist. Very, very simple arrangement.
I sit and watch the candle and the flicker of the flame. My writhing shadow twists and turns as though it is in pain. I'm trying to escape.
escape the memory my heart recalls. And I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls.
You know, but there's a lot of, if you Google it, there's a lot of rockabilly versions of it come up from Europe, okay. You know, in Denmark and all that. There's bands that, you know, so the song certainly had some league.
Good for him, though. It's amazing. Like, again, he's working. He's probably, he said he was doing some sort of interviewing and writing and stuff. Like writing for a magazine or something too at the same time.
Yeah, and Dad for years wrote articles in the Barn Dance magazine.
Okay.
Like when they revived them in the, well, maybe in the 90s, but Earl Haywood got the Barn Dance shows going again, and they're still going to this day. And they have a newsletter for all their subscribers, and Dad wrote a column for that. And he wrote columns for the Country Music News, and because he knew everything. Again, when he died, I had to get rid of huge collections he had, because he cut clippings of magazines from every country mag, every mention of any country artist, he would clip it and file it. He had a row of, a whole wall covered with filing cabinets of all
You're
clippings.
Kidding. Okay.
So he could dig up anything on anybody and, you know, write about it.
Did he travel as well? Because, like, I know you talked a lot about Kitchener-Waterloo area and
No, Dad never really traveled. It was always in Ontario,
okay.
You know, within, you know, pretty much within 100 miles of here. Because, again, like, the band didn't really, you know, for whatever reasons, his band, the Pine River Troubadours, broke up sometime maybe in the early 60s. And then Dad wasn't playing for years through most of the 60s. He would just be writing songs. I know for a while he became an exclusive songwriter for Central Songs, which was a Nashville publishing company.
Okay, that's neat.
So he was on a contract with them, so all his songs would go to them. Again, I don't think any hits came out of that. I just saw the rejection letter where they terminated it after so long. But he was always sending out songs, and I, you know, my memories of childhood when I was really young, I remember sneaking out of bed when I was like 3 or 4 years old to go to the top of the stairs because my dad's band would be practicing downstairs.
Yeah, okay.
You know, the whole upstairs of the house, us kids would be sleeping in bed and everybody, all the adults were downstairs, but I'd be at the top of the stairs listening to the music.
Now, where was your childhood home? Like right in Kitchener then? Or?
In 56, my dad bought a home in Kitchener. Or sorry, in Waterloo, actually. We briefly lived in Kitchener, but then he moved to North Waterloo, right on the edge of town. Now, Columbia Street.
Yeah.
That's where, that was the last street out in those days. We had cows grazing in our backyard. Now there's miles of city up towards Conestoga Mall. That's where I grew up. We lived there until 1970. Dad then moved out to Elmira, Floridale, actually, outside Elmira. Yeah, but I remember Dad had a little den in the basement. He had a great big roll-top desk. This desk, I always wanted one. Dad's ultimately fell apart. But it was a huge one, and he had all his jam filled with songs and lead sheets and all that, and he'd be pecking away on his typewriter, typing out the song. Dad could actually read and write music, which is not that common, actually, in country music, in actually in any form of music. But he actually did. I think he briefly took piano when he was a kid. They actually taught him how to read and write music so he could write out lead sheets for all his songs. Or not lead sheet. Lead sheets are usually just words and chords, but he could actually write out sheet music for everything. So he'd send that out. And then later on, as I said, you know, you had to send demos with, you know, so Dad would make up what he could on his Grundig tape recorder, sound on sound in the bass. Later on, demos were expected to be a lot more sophisticated.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, today demos sound pretty much like you could put them on the radio, you know. But back then it might just be somebody with their guitar singing or something. And, you know, Dad might add, you know, beating on a suitcase or something to add like a drum beat in the background, you know.
Yeah.
Later on, Dad got a Teac four-track.
Okay, machine. Yep. I know what you're talking about.
It was actually a four-track reel-to-reel. They came out around 1970, and I think they cost like $3,000 back then. That was a lot of money. Things weigh like 70 pounds because I've got it.
Oh, yeah.
Dad's
really?
Old Teac. It doesn't work very well, but it does still work because I'd like to transcribe. I've got lots of tapes from Dad.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Yeah.
And I'd like to transfer it to digital, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
But anyway, I think the Teac will have to get new heads or something. But anyway, that machine, they were actually really good. You could make an album on them. And apparently, the pop band, the Eurythmics, actually made their first album on one of those machines.
Wow, okay.
You know, at home. So, you know, they were that good quality. So Dad did get one of those in later years, but he got his used years later.
I did some research before this interview, and your dad had a band called the Hummingbirds? Or?
Yeah, that's the one I played in. That's, oh, okay. That's where I finally got, okay. Came out. Yeah, that
and he,
was...
And he did record at that point, right? Or did he yes, make an album yes. before that?
Yeah, we made an album in the 70s. I have okay. it on CD. I have it on vinyl, too. We made it on great. Vinyl. So, yeah, so my dad didn't play through the 60s, and after... winding in the Pine River Troubadours. Towards around 68 or so, and that's just when I was a teenager. You know, I started high school in 67. So, you know, I can remember all this stuff. I know Dad, I don't want to get back out playing again. So he formed a band called the Hummingbirds, which, you know, was a bit of a corny name, but it certainly got a lot of use over the years. You know, that's when his old Gibson J200 had the finish all bashed and scratched up, so Dad had it sanded right off and wood burned his name on the guitar, and I drew up a hummingbird motif, like on the pick guard of the Gibson guitar okay, around, yeah. And Dad wood burned that on it, so destroying any collectible value of this very, very nice old guitar. But anyway, that was when he formed the Hummingbirds. It was around 68. And at that time, what wasn't true before, all of a sudden, every bar had music.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was the baby boomers.
Oh, yeah.
I'm an example. We were just hitting our teens, so bars were just booming. In those days, you could get work anywhere, you know. So Dad started playing, and they started, he had various, he started a trio. Just my mom would play bass, Dad played rhythm guitar.
Really?
And
okay.
They'd usually have a lead guitar player with them.
Yeah.
No drums yet.
Okay.
In those days, 68, 69.
Yeah, even things at the Legions and stuff must have just happened, I bet.
Like, oh, well, everything was.
So
yeah.
busy, yeah.
Yeah. We did mostly bars, you know. So Dad started around 68, 69. I know when I was still in high school, I was making my spending money by babysitting my younger brothers and sisters while okay. Mom and Dad were out playing in the yep. early Hummingbirds gigs, you know. And again, at that time, I wouldn't admit to liking country music, wouldn't play in public. You know, I was hanging out with my hippie friends. I was listening to Jimi Hendrix, and oh, yeah. Steppenwolf was one of my favorite
yeah, for
bands.
Sure. We're just about out of time on today's episode of Musicians FAQ, but there's so much more to come in our interview series with Lance Rusworm. While we'll still be learning more in future episodes about Lynn and the many musical paths he has taken, we'll also be discovering Lance's rich musical past and hear many of his own songwriting projects. Let's end today's program with a song off the 1976 Hummingbirds album called Down Home in Newfoundland, written and sung by Lynn Rusworm. Until next time, it's Steve Todd, and thank you for listening to Musicians FAQ on 102.7 CKMS.
Gonna get my gear together and hit the road again. I'm changing my direction, gonna leave from where I've been. Got a yearning to be back there with the folks I understand. Gonna plant my feet on Happy Street down home in Newfoundland. Down home in Newfoundland, where the sun's gonna shine on a happy man. That's where I'm gonna lose all my sorrow. Down home in Newfoundland, where the air is fresh and you feel so grand. I'll be there tomorrow. I spent some time in Montreal, but the city wasn't me. So I thumped along on the 401 and I headed for BC. But I couldn't find the place for mine, and so I've changed my plan. Gonna thumb her back to that little shack down home in Newfoundland. Down home in Newfoundland, where the sun's gonna shine on a happy man. That's where I'm gonna lose all my sorrow. Down home in Newfoundland, where the air is fresh and you feel so grand. I'll be there tomorrow. There's something about a new pea that ties him to his home. His heart is there though anywhere, his footsteps chance to roam. Where tomorrow's round the corner and they help you if they can. Gonna see the folks I love the most down home in Newfoundland. Down home in Newfoundland, where the sun's gonna shine on a happy man. That's where I'm gonna lose all my sorrow. Down home in Newfoundland, where the air is fresh and you feel so grand. I'll be there tomorrow. Down home in Newfoundland.